Hello, today is Wednesday, June 3rd, 2026. Following is a 60-minute reading coming to you from the Talking Information Center, featuring the latest edition of Time Magazine. My name is Fred. Health. Former YouTube CEO Susan Wojcicki. You decide. W-O-J-C-I-C-K-I. Wojcicki. Anyway, Susan died from lung cancer in 2024. Her family is trying to find out just why that is. This piece is by Alice Park. It started with pain in her hip. Susan Wojcicki, 54 at the time, and the CEO of YouTube, was a frequent runner and often swam in the company pool. But it's just sore muscles, she thought, hoping the pain would resolve itself. She was in Europe attending a conference in the summer of 2022 and didn't have time to give it much thought. When the pain persisted after she returned home to California, she decided to get an MRI. The scan said she had cancer. Stunned, Wojcicki called her primary care doctor, who was equally surprised and suggested she repeat the scan. She texted her sister Janet, a professor of pediatrics and epidemiology at the University of California, San Francisco, and told her the report showed some bone cancer. She said, I did it at a questionable radiology center because I wanted a quick MRI, so I'm going to repeat it, says Janet, who connected her sister to a radiologist friend. Even then, I was joking with my friend that we didn't think it was possibly real. The second scan showed the same thing. And doctors believed that the cancer found in Wojcicki's bones had spread there from another source. Sure enough, it was cancer. And it was metastatic, says Wojcicki's husband, Dennis Tropper, a project management director at Google. It was a bomb dropping in the room. Wojcicki had lung cancer, which kills more than 125,000 Americans each year, more than any other cancer. It wasn't on her radar. She'd never been a smoker. She was healthy, active, and only in her early 50s. Yet people like Wojcicki, who don't fit the classic picture of someone with lung cancer, are increasingly developing the disease, while people with a smoking history make up the bulk of lung cancer cases and deaths. Up to 20% of new diagnoses in the U.S. and worldwide are in non-smokers. By the time most of these cases are diagnosed, they have already advanced and spread to other organs, at which point the disease is difficult or, often, impossible to treat. Wojcicki decided not to reveal her diagnosis publicly and continued to work at YouTube until stepping down in early 2023. Behind the scenes, she and her sister, Anne, who founded genetic testing company 23andMe, and Janet spent the next 2 years aggressively searching for answers to the questions Wojcicki asked herself over and over again. Why did this happen? Was there something she could have done to prevent this cancer? She tested her home for radon, the second leading cause of lung cancer behind smoking, and investigated air pollution patterns where she lived, but none yielded satisfactory answers. In the search for better treatments for her advanced disease, it became clear that she was at the vanguard of an ignored group of people who were falling through the cracks of lung cancer care. After exploring and trying various cutting-edge therapies, including by joining clinical trials testing experimental approaches, Wojcicki passed away in 2024. Several months after her death, her family posted a letter on YouTube that she had written, revealing her cancer journey and her intention to fight for better understanding and cures for this disease. Although Wosicki died without knowing why she was, or why she developed lung cancer, her family hasn't stopped looking for answers. In some of the first interviews about Wosicki's cancer journey, they shared with Time and also with Good Morning America their decision to launch the Susan Wosicki Foundation in order to fund efforts to diagnose lung cancer earlier, particularly for non-smokers, and change recommendations about who should be screened for the disease. Inspired by organizations such as the Michael J. Fox Foundation for Parkinson's Disease and the Susan G. Komen Foundation for Breast Cancer, the family hopes to reframe how the public views lung cancer and change screening guidelines to include anyone, not just smokers, who might be at higher risk. If you look at non-smoking lung cancer, this is the fifth largest killer of all cancers, says Troper. It's a crisis. I met Wosicki's sister and husband at the family's farm, which is a short walk from their home in Los Altos Hills, California. The garden, beekeeping hives, and coop with more than a dozen egg-laying chickens were all Wosicki's idea, a way to connect your five children to nature and part of Wosicki's healthy lifestyle. In addition to exercising almost every day, she avoided sugar and ate naturally grown food as much as possible. Before the cancer diagnosis, the farm was where the Wosicki sisters and their families would spend time together and gather for holidays. After, it became something of a headquarters for the family and the experts they invited over to figure out how to defeat her cancer. From day one, this was a project, says Anne, of the fight to save her sister's life, similar to the ones they would embark upon as children. I remember Susan calling us and saying, "You guys are in charge. I can't deal with this, so I'm putting you guys in charge of solving this." A more qualified team could hardly have been assembled. The Wosicki sisters are all such recognized leaders in the fields of science and technology that Mattel released Barbies in their likeness in 2023 as part of its STEM series. The sisters grew up on the campus of Stanford University, where their father was a physics professor, and were always involved in projects together, from making and selling spice ropes to putting on magic shows. Their parents had always encouraged them to be independent thinkers and voice their opinions. "We grew up thinking that it was a very negative thing to not speak your mind," says Janet. After learning about her sister's diagnosis, Anne called dozens of her contacts in the medical community from her years of building 23andMe, which declared bankruptcy as a commercial testing company in 2025, but now exists as a nonprofit research organization. The 23andMe Research Institute, which Anne runs, she and Janet visited leading experts at the National Institutes of Health, who weren't optimistic about Wosicki's chances. Hearing this from experts on science's cutting edge was a watershed moment, Janet says. They said, "It looks really bad. You should go home and appreciate the time you have." But the sisters couldn't simply accept the dire prognosis. It goes back to our childhood and the mindset of being fearless and always stepping up, says Anne. "We had no issue calling up the hands of different institutions and saying, 'We have a problem.' We were super aggressive advocates. We felt this is a research problem. This is a research problem. We can absolutely tackle this." Driving the determination was the fast-changing world of cancer therapies, including breakthroughs in immune-based treatments and cell-based strategy known as CAR-T, which they were convinced would help their sisters. The hope was that science is moving really rapidly, and it was almost like in Susan's mind, she needed to stay alive long enough to capture some of those changes in innovation. says Anne. But we knew it was an uphill battle. The sisters soon learned that lung cancer in young non-smokers is generally driven by specific genetic mutations that are not present in people who get smoking-related lung cancer. The good news is that certain targeted therapies address those mutations and can extend survival. But these are most effective if started early in the disease, before tumors spread to other organs. Even if the family couldn't do it in time to help their sister, they thought figuring out how to treat patients like her could be Wosicki's legacy. Since before her diagnosis, Wosicki and Tropa had been funding cancer research projects through their joint philanthropic efforts. That work, combined with the projects that Janet and Anne were pursuing to learn more about early onset lung cancer, formed the seed of the Susan Wosicki Foundation. The Susan Wosicki Foundation. Excuse me. The Tropa and Wosicki families have committed $150 million to launch the foundation. Melinda French Gates, Google and Salesforce, whose CEO and co-founder Mark Benioff owns time with his wife Lynn, they have also provided significant contributions. In addition to funding research, the foundation is working closely with YouTube to raise awareness and change the public perception that lung cancer is solely a disease caused by smoking. Wosicki had set the stage for such a health education role for YouTube years before she learned she had cancer. At a time when the platform was more known for promoting fluffy content, Wosicki wanted to harness its influence for more substantive goals. She recruited Dr. Garth Graham, then at CVS Health, to head up a new initiative at YouTube to provide reliable, validated health information from qualified sources. The idea she had was that many people start their health care journeys on Google and YouTube, and video is a very important part of demystifying complex clinical topics, heart disease, diabetes, and a cancer diagnosis, says Graham. Graham is now designing a strategy that will make YouTube a resource for both the public and healthcare providers to learn about the risks of lung cancer among non-smokers and to inform them about the latest early detection developments as these advances occur. Google, which was started in Wosicki's garage when she took a chance on two Stanford graduate students and where she was the 16th employee, is also working with the foundation to leverage AI-based analysis to accelerate the search for risk factors. AI gives us an historical opportunity to understand the why, and then we want to move into the what, Graham says. What do you do? How do we save more lives? And how do we move forward on the issue of early detection? Lung cancer is among the few cancers for which screening is determined by a lifestyle choice, smoking, in addition to age. The stigma and guilt surrounding lung cancer caused by smoking means that screening rates for the disease have always been and continue to remain low. Screening guidelines involve some complicated, non-intuitive math. People who should currently get screened for lung cancer include adults ages 50 to 80 who smoke the equivalent of a pack a day for 20 years, who currently smoke or have quit in the past 15 years. Even within this high-risk category, only about 18% to 20% of eligible people in the U.S. get the screening test, a low-dose CT scan. Breast, colon, and prostate cancers all have broad age-related screening guidelines that have contributed to drops in deaths from these conditions. Osicki's sisters, as well as many lung cancer experts, argue that it's time to broaden who's eligible for lung cancer screening, because smoking captures only some of those at risk. In their quest to cure Wosicki's cancer, the sisters recognize that non-smokers who develop lung cancer are a massively understudied population. Scientists still didn't know basic information about lung cancer in non-smokers, including the comprehensive range of genetic factors driving the disease. Just a month before her death in July 2024, the sisters opened the lung cancer genetic study to uncover more of those genes. They have some hints from the few studies that have been done on non-smokers who develop the cancer. Those increasingly show that the disease tends to disproportionately affect women, especially Asian women. It's a different demographic from Wosicki's, but could provide clues about what other factors are driving lung cancer besides cigarettes. In 2021, researchers in Taiwan conducted a nationwide study at 17 hospitals of non-smokers with lung cancer risk factors like a family history of the disease, smoking, tuberculosis, and exposure to secondhand smoke or poorly ventilated cooking areas. The participants received a low-dose CT to look for lung cancer, and it was detected in 2.6% of the group. Encouragingly, 96% of those cases were detected at stage 0 or stage 1. Having a family history of lung cancer was the most significant risk factor of those studied, but the findings revealed how prevalent lung cancer was among people who didn't smoke. Based on the results, health officials in Taiwan are now starting to screen more non-smokers there with those risk factors. At NYU's Perlmutter Cancer Center, Dr. Elaine Shum conducted a similar study. She screened 1,000 Asian American women who had those sorts of risk factors and found cancer in 1.3% of cases, which is a higher rate than the one reported in a national lung cancer screening trial of smokers. If I had stage 1 lung cancer, I would want it to be picked up, says Iona Cheng, professor of epidemiology and biostatistics at UCSF. She and her colleague Scarlett Lynn Gomez oversee the Bay Area portion of California's Cancer Registry, a database of all cancer cases diagnosed in the state that is part of the U.S.'s national surveillance system of the disease. They began exploring risk factors for lung cancer among non-smokers after a cancer doctor at Stanford University asked them whether the growing number of young, non-smoking Asian women with lung cancer that she was seeing was part of a broader trend or unique to her patient population. Cheng and Gomez received a grant from the National Institutes of Health to launch the Female Asian Non-Smoker Study, or FANS, to analyze the trend. We were able to answer, yes, rates are higher among Asian families, or rather, excuse me, rates are higher among Asian females who never smoked relative to other ethnic groups of females who never smoked, says Gomez. So FANS is now taking the next step to ask the question, why? Other scientists are also mining databases for clues about what makes some non-smokers vulnerable to lung cancer. Hillary Robbins and Matthias Johansson, both scientists at the International Agency for Research on Cancer, known as IARC, at the World Health Organization, received one of the first two grants from the Susan Wojcicki Foundation to hunt for factors in the blood that could flag non-smokers at higher risk of developing lung cancer. The database they're mining contains blood samples from more than 7,000 non-smokers who develop lung cancer. Often there are proteins perturbed by early signs of disease, says Johannesson. Johansson. Those are the signals we are looking for in our research. So much of cancer care today is built around treating cancer after it occurs rather than trying to detect it before it ravages the body. That's a mindset the Susan Wojcicki Foundation hopes to help challenge, or change rather. The foundation hopes to help change with the other initial grant to maintain another repository of blood samples from non-smokers diagnosed with lung cancer. Dr. Sana Rauf, radiation oncologist at Brown University Health Center Institute, oversees the biobank and plans to scour samples for any molecular signals circulating in the blood that could distinguish them from those who don't develop cancer. This is the future of the war on cancer, she says. Such lab-based tests, if developed, could detect cancer far earlier. Right now, we're catching cancers in late stages in the majority of never smokers. Until that changes, it really felt to me that it doesn't matter what types of therapies we come up with, because we are not addressing the root problem. Rauf knows the challenges of creating blood tests for cancer. Well-funded efforts to pick up multiple different cancers from the blood have not been successful to date. But with advances in AI and in the understanding of the genetic changes driving some of these cancers, and with enough samples from patients, she believes such a test could be available soon. The power of the foundation is that it can help accelerate the search for new people with newly diagnosed lung cancer who are rather low risk, she says. There is a whole world of molecular biology out there that has not entered the space of screening. We believe the future of reducing deaths from lung cancer is early detection. If and when such a test for picking up lung cancers early becomes available, the next challenge will be putting it in the hands of doctors where it can have the most impact. That's where Wojcicki's experience and vision at YouTube may become a critical factor. The education and awareness campaigns that the foundation plans for the platform will ideally prepare public-funded and healthcare professionals to advocate for lung cancer screening in a wider population, once data support that the practice is safe and effective. Many people are unaware of the impact lung cancer has, particularly on non-smokers, says Graham of YouTube Health. One of Susan's major visions was the idea of demystifying health and how to create healthcare information that is engaging and understandable. In this case, it's about how the general public should understand the risks around lung cancer, the warning signs, and the importance of screening. We also know a significant amount of clinicians come to YouTube for things like medication education. So it's an opportunity to educate the clinician community as well. Her family says Wojcicki didn't explicitly express her desire to establish a foundation or a specific initiative around lung cancer cases like hers, because throughout treatment she expected to beat the odds and stay one step ahead of the disease. She received her last therapy in an immune-based experimental treatment for lung cancer involving retraining her T-cells to attack her cancer at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Institute in New York City. She was hopeful enough that this treatment, which is now approved for melanoma but not yet for lung cancer, would buy her more time, and she looked for an apartment in New York, anticipating returning for additional treatments. We walked into Memorial Sloan Kettering thinking we would come out a month later cancer-free from the treatment, says Troper. We had high hopes until the very end. After Wojcicki passed away, it was clear to her family that the work needed to continue. even if it hadn't been able to save her life. This is something we have the imperative to carry on, Anne says. Susan's name should be associated with all the things she did with her career, but I think hopefully she is also associated with saving thousands of lives because she's destigmatized it and advocated for early detection. The family is also determined to finally answer the question that started it all. Why did she get this? I remember Susan and I were in the hospital room, and she was very weak at that point, says Troper, becoming emotional at the memory. But she looked me in the eye and said, Dennis, I don't care what you do when I'm not here, but do something meaningful. And that's what Dennis is doing. Rest in peace, Susan Wosicki. Okay, moving to the brief. Power Trip by Charlie Campbell. Trump's visit to China underscored how global authority is shifting to the East. He may have descended Air Force One late May 13th to the chairs of school children, brandishing the stars and stripes, and flanked by tech's most influential tycoons, but it didn't take long for Trump to be put in his place in Beijing. In their first closed-door discussions, Chinese President Xi Jinping issued a stinging rebuke on American arms sales to Taiwan, warning the superpowers could collide or even enter into conflict over the self-ruling island over which China claims sovereignty. Given that Trump can explode at even relatively trifling perceived affronts, pulling 5,000 American troops out of Germany after Chancellor Friedrich Merz and the U.S. had been humiliated in Iran, it was telling that Yi felt empowered to lay down the law from the get-go. Indeed, the most enduring image from the entire visit is the two leaders standing outside the Ming Dynasty Temple of Heaven, with Trump remaining curiously tight-lipped as reporters inquired whether they had discussed Taiwan. China is beautiful, Trump offered instead. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio insisted that U.S. policy on Taiwan remained unchanged, but the optics of the U.S. president, for whom belligerence has long been a badge of honor, sadly, appearing awkward and cowed is a stark illustration of the shifting balance of global power. He felt he has license to make discordant warnings seemingly without concern about blowback or displeasure from Trump's side, says Sung Wen T, a scholar focused on China's leadership at the Australian National University. He appeared tough in public in front of Trump and got away with it. That projection of strength may be surprising given the very real challenges China faces, including an economy struggling from a prolonged property crisis, weak consumer demand, and slowing growth. But China has also proved extraordinarily resilient. With a record $1.2 trillion trade surplus last year, despite U.S. tariffs that peaked at 145%, in April, China reported record monthly exports rising 14.1% year-on-year, owed partly to buoyant demand for green tech products from electric vehicles to wind turbines and batteries, demonstrating its ability to not just withstand disruptions from the Iran war, but benefit from it. That includes the soft power rewards of Washington's tarnishing its international image, particularly across the global South, which disproportionately feels the brunt of soaring energy prices. Beijing's contention has always been that America behaves as a thuggish, self-interested warmonger, says Nick Bisley, a professor of international relations at Australia's La Trobe University. And it's like, yep, this ticks the box. Whether fallout from Iran had sapped his mojo or he was merely beset by jet lag, Trump appeared on the back foot throughout his stint in the Middle Kingdom. He did not regale reporters on the long flight to Beijing, and when he protested, or rather when he posted on Truth Social, it was to defend Yi, who had implied that the U.S. was in decline by warning of the dangers of a Thucydides trap when an ascendant power and a weakening one may come to blows. Trump spoke not of statecraft, but of details, touting a Chinese commitment to purchase 200 planes, saying that's a lot of jobs. The White House later said China agreed to purchase at least $17 billion of American agricultural products per year through 2028, on top of the 25 million metric tons of soybeans annually over the same period agreed in October. The headline numbers look very impressive, says Chong Jia Ian, a professor of international relations at the National University of Singapore. But I would be a little bit cautious because we've seen this movie before, whether the Chinese side follows through. Yi will be gladdened by the sheer number of long-standing bugbears that were given a pass, including religious rights, media freedoms, labor rights, the crackdown on Tibetans and Uyghur Muslims, eroding freedoms in semi-autonomous Hong Kong, and Chinese support for Russia and North Korea. There wasn't even a sense that Trump tried to hold Beijing's feet to the fire on strategic matters such as cyber espionage, IP theft, or the export of fentanyl precursors. Yi's choice of words also spoke volumes. China is never shy about trumpeting its partnerships with scores of nations, even though they're invariably lopsided and wholly transactional. But with Trump, Yi eschewed any semblance of partnership and merely advocated a framework of constructive strategic stability, indicating he settled that the U.S. is a rival and, while not wanting ties to spiral, is confident in China's ability to hold its own. As Trump departed Beijing on May 15th, he gave a fist pump at the door of Air Force One, while another cheering crowd waved more U.S. flags. "It's been an incredible visit," Trump told Yi. "I think a lot of good has come of it." But it was difficult to see the trip as anything other than a changing of the guard. The Bulletin. Who declares global Ebola emergency? That's capital WHO. The World Health Organization declared a fast-moving Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo, the DRC, and Uganda, a public health emergency of international concern on May 17th after the virus killed nearly 90 people and spread across an area blighted by conflict. WHO officials said that the outbreak didn't meet the criteria for a pandemic emergency, but warned of a high regional risk owing to population movement, porous borders, and ongoing transmission in multiple health zones. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said he was deeply concerned about the scale and speed of the epidemic in a briefing at the World Health Assembly in Geneva on May 19th. By then, the number of deaths had risen to more than 130 and suspected cases to at least 500. Health officials said the outbreak was being driven by the Bundibugyo strain of Ebola, a rare variant first identified in Uganda in 2007. The strain has been reported in two previous outbreaks, but has no approved virus-specific therapeutics or vaccines. The virus is transmitted through direct contact with bodily fluids, including blood, vomit, and other contaminated materials, and becomes contagious once symptoms appear. Those symptoms can include fever, vomiting, diarrhea, muscle pain, and internal or external bleeding. Initial laboratory tests were not capable of detecting the Bundibugyo strain, delaying confirmation of the outbreak, according to the WHO. Relief hindered. Violence in eastern Congo, including attacks by armed groups such as the Allied Democratic Forces and M23, has limited access for health workers and disrupted contact tracing efforts, the WHO said. Officials noted that only a small fraction of suspected cases have been confirmed in laboratories so far, highlighting the uncertainty about the outbreak's true scale. International response. The WHO's declaration, its second highest alert level, is intended to mobilize international coordination funding. Or it's intended to mobilize international coordination, funding, and response capacity. The agency urged countries to strengthen surveillance, isolate confirmed cases, and monitor contacts for up to 21 days, while discouraging border closures that could drive cases underground. But the global response system is hampered by the shuttering of the U.S. Agency for International Development, which played a central role in containing previous Ebola outbreaks, and the withdrawal of the U.S. from the WHO in January. The DRC has experienced at least 17 Ebola outbreaks since the virus was first identified in 1976. The largest outbreak from 2018 to 2020 killed nearly 2,300 people. Sticking with the brief news, what's in the Pentagon's newly released U.S. UFO files? This piece is by Jeffrey Kluger. On May 8th, Trump ordered the release of more than 170 files on a Department of Defense website that included reported eyewitness accounts of unidentified flying objects, or what are more decorously known as unidentified anomalous phenomena, UAPs. Some of the accounts are from lay folks, some are from commercial pilots, and some from Navy pilots who have captured videos through their windshields of what appeared to be alien craft bobbing and hovering in ways no aircraft can manage. Here are some of the most intriguing examples of the reports, sure to generate speculation, but at this point likely to remain a mystery. On August 9th, 1952, in a teletype labeled Urgent, addressed to the FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover, two employees of the DuPont Chemical Plant in Savannah River, South Carolina, reported seeing a blue light with an orange fringe shaped like a saucer. It made its appearance at 9:30 p.m., flying at a high rate of speed and traveling in a northeastern direction. The message did not reach Hoover, and 2 days later he responded with a "not my department" demurral. Inasmuch as the matter of the flying saucer or saucers is being investigated by the United States Air Force, he wrote, "I am forwarding a copy of your letter to the Director of Special Investigations, Department of the Air Force." Another incident was more hands-on. On September 27, 1950, two officers with the Philadelphia Police Department were patrolling in their squad car when they reportedly saw a 6-foot-wide object landing gently in a nearby field. The officers, upon examining it, noted that it gave off a purplish glow, according to the report. After looking at the object for some time, they attempted to pick it up. The object broke, leaving a slight odorless residue. For a period of about 25 minutes, it completely disintegrated. Okay. Commercial airline pilots have filed sightings too. On August 4th, 1947, a Pan American airliner flying the route from Gander, Newfoundland to LaGuardia Field in New York City said that they came upon a flying gold-colored cylinder about 15 feet long. One of the pilots estimated the speed of the object at about 175 miles per hour and that it was traveling in an easterly direction, according to the file. The other pilot then spotted a similar object on the other side of the plane. The sightings continued for 90 seconds before the object vanished. A report was even filed by the Gemini 7 mission on December Gemini 7 mission on December 4th, 1965, after the spacecraft reached orbit, the crew separated from the upper stage booster and turned around to face that spent segment. The astronauts, Commander Frank Borman and pilot Jim Lovell, saw not just the upper stage, but also another larger object they could not explain. Excuse me. We have a boogie at 10 o'clock. Hi. This is an actual sighting. It's called Borman. In a scribbled note that is part of the document dump, a NASA official wrote the words UFO sighting by Borman. It's the naval aviator sightings, however, that are generating the most buzz because they have video evidence to back them up. The document tranche includes a January 1, 2020 encounter with the video included online of a bright dancing point moving erratically, spotted by the pilot of an aircraft patrolling the skies over the Middle East. The object lingered in sight for 1 minute and 3 seconds before it disappeared. Even more striking was the sighting on New Year's Day 2024 of a football-shaped body with three fin-like projections, one pointing vertically and two pointing downward at 45-degree angles. That object remained visible for just 9 seconds before disappearing. Perhaps most sensational of all, however, were the fresh details about a 1 minute, 45 second appearance in 2013 of an eight-pointed star-like body swerving and maneuvering in front of a naval jet, leaving a fine contrail of exhaust behind it. All of the reports in the files remain objects of speculation and would be followed by more such reports, which the Department of Defense promises will be forthcoming on a rolling basis. If the UAPs are out there, the American public will have an opportunity to learn about them. Milestones. The late show's last bow. I guess this is under the section of aired. The Late Show's Last Bow. Stephen Colbert says goodnight. This piece is by Rebecca Sofer. Stephen Colbert took over The Late Show from its original host, David Letterman, in 2015. And in the years between then and the show's final episode, which aired May 21, he achieved something extraordinary, making it normal to talk about the hardest parts of being alive. Colbert wasn't just funny. He had a way of revealing the full scope of a guest's humanity. He created moments where the difficult human experiences weren't packaged into something easier to sit with or made tidy. They stayed there, unresolved, in front of millions, like his 2021 interview with actor Andrew Garfield, who spoke about grieving his mother, or one of Colbert's many conversations with Cooper, Anderson Cooper, reflecting on the deaths of Cooper's parents with a clarity that didn't rush toward closure. Colbert himself often returned to the loss of his father and brothers in a plane crash when he was a child, as well as his mother's death. These moments didn't resolve. They didn't pivot neatly back to promotion or punchlines. They simply existed, often sandwiched between humorous and sometimes absurd segments. Television often struggles to hold difficult human experience unless it can be shaped into something digestible, or it's reserved for moments of collective catastrophe. In last year's acceptance speech after winning his Emmy for Outstanding Talk Series, Colbert shared how he had set out to make a late-night show about love, but later realized, quote, "We were doing a late-night comedy show about loss." And that's related to love, because sometimes you only truly know how much you love something when you get a sense you might be losing it. In his decades of late-night television, Colbert showed that love and loss are insufferable. Well, I hope he stays around. We get to hear more from him. Speaking of lost, Elon Musk. OpenAI lawsuit. A California jury dealt a blow to Elon Musk's AI ambitions on May 18th by rejecting his lawsuit against his competitor and one-time associate, Sam Altman. Objecting to OpenAI turning for profit, Musk sued in 2024. The jury found that statutory deadlines had been exceeded. Musk has said he will appeal. If the suit had proceeded, OpenAI and its partner Microsoft would have owed up to roughly $150 billion in damages, and Altman might have been removed from OpenAI's board. Instead, Musk's own AI company looks weaker than ever, says analyst Peter Wildford. During the trial, Musk seemed to admit that SpaceX AI partly trains its chatbot on OpenAI's models, a strategy often adopted by lagging AI companies. Outside the courtroom, SpaceX AI agreed to rent all of the computing capacity at one of its flagship data centers to competitor Anthropic. In an acrimonious AI race, the verdict is the latest sign that Musk may be falling behind the pack. Okay. The high price of attending the World Cup. This piece is by Sean Gregory. There's the viral ad from Canadian carrier Air Transit showing how much cheaper it is to fly to some countries than attend their soccer games at the World Cup. Watch England tickets at $3,402. See England round-trip tickets starting at $779. Then there are the eye-popping asking prices on the World Cup secondary market. In mid-May on FIFA's resale platform, the cheapest tickets for the July 19th World Cup final at MetLife Stadium outside New York City was going for $9,200. The richest asking price, $11,499,000. Good luck shedding that one, pal. And don't forget the brouhaha over train fare. New Jersey Transit announced in April that it would charge fans $150 to get from Penn Station to MetLife on game days, a round trip that typically costs around $13. In May, it cut the price to $98. The 2026 World Cup, co-hosted by the U.S., Canada, and Mexico, is costing a small fortune for both spectators and local governments tasked with welcoming international soccer fans. Football unites the world, FIFA is fond of boasting, but this year's tournament risks bringing together fans of a certain tax bracket while pricing out some of the game's most passionate supporters. FIFA has embraced the sort of dynamic pricing customers find when shopping for airline tickets. Costs fluctuate in real time based on demand. In May, for example, it was charging at face value $1,940 for an upper-tier seat to the opener for the U.S. men's national team, a game against Paraguay at SoFi Stadium in Inglewood, California, on June 12th. And FIFA's own resale site charges both buyer and seller an additional 15%, increasing the soccer body's haul as seats change hands. There's some element of greed there, says Kate Ashley, a professor of Northeastern University's DeMore McKim School of Business. To justify this model, FIFA president Gianni Infantino has pointed to the robust U.S. resale market. Since tickets are likely to sell above face value on a secondary platform, the organization is trying to match those numbers in initial sale price as much as possible. FIFA's approach could backfire. Excuse me, plenty of tickets remain unsold. Anyone up for $1,300 front-level tickets for the Haiti-Scotland group stage match in Foxborough, Mass., on June 13th. Plus, sticker shock may be deterring travelers from making the trip, according to a report from the American Hotel and Lodging Association released in early May. Close to 80% of survey respondents across U.S. host cities said that bookings are tracking below initial expectations. Forecasts show that domestic travelers are outpacing international travelers, the report concluded, which is concerning for metro areas betting on an economic boost. International visitors spend money in hotels, restaurants, and shops that would not otherwise be spent. Thankfully, fans can still hack this pricey World Cup. Over the 30-day period prior to May 19th, secondary market prices dropped more than 20% on average. For group stage matches, according to TicketData.com, you could keep waiting it out for even better deals. Host cities are also staging free fan fests and watch parties at places like Centennial Olympic Park in Atlanta. It's great to be inside the stadium at a match, says Lee Eigel, a professor at NYU's Tisch Institute for Global Sport. Quote, sometimes it's equally great to be outside of the stadium or further away from the stadium and just be around people who are enjoying themselves around this sport. Like at the pub, that classic World Cup locale, sharing an experience with other rabid supporters in front of a big screen. $10 pitchers instead of $2,000 seats. There have been worse backup plans. Now to milestones. Discovered. A 2,000-year-old mummy with a papyrus fragment of Homer's Iliad. By archaeologists from the mission at the University of Barcelona, the university said on April 20th. Let's do that again. It's talking about a mummy with a P-A-P-Y-R-U-S, papyrus. Maybe that's papyrus fragment. It's a papyrus fragment of Homer's I-L-L-A-D. Archaeologists found that, and they were from the mission of the University of Barcelona. That was on April 20th. Sold, Jason Pollock's number 7A, 1948. Widely considered one of the first abstract paintings, at auction for a record $181 million on May 8th. That'll be worth Googling that just to see what that piece of art looks like. That's the number 7A, 1948 by Jackson Pollock. Died former Massachusetts representative and champion of gay rights, Barney Frank, at 86 on May 19th, according to reports. Dropped. Don Trump's $10 billion lawsuit against the IRS over his leaked tax reforms, or tax returns, rather, in exchange for the creation of a $1.8 billion taxpayer-funded anti-weaponization fund to compensate those who allege they were unfairly targeted by the Biden administration. It's a good thing to drop. One, the Eurovision Song Contest. This was won by Bulgaria's Dara on May 16th, marking the country's first win since the international music competition began in 1956. Well, good for her. And on that note, we are going to wrap it up. It's been a pleasure reading for you on this third day of the sixth month in the year 2026. I hope you've enjoyed listening. And better still, I hope you have a wonderful day. Please do take care. My name is Fred.